Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 19th, 2008, and this is show number 174. I know there's all these new Mac laptops to talk about, but first I wanted to tell you something much more important. I have finally posted my Cars I Have Waxed album up on Flickr. I know you've all been waiting for that, so I put a link in the show notes so you can scamper off and see them right away. Well, all right, let's talk about Macintoshes. Why not? As you have probably figured out by now, Apple announced new notebooks, major updates to both the MacBook and the MacBook Pro. You also probably know that I've been dying to get a new MacBook Pro, right? Well, oddly, the 2 gigahertz Intel Core Duo MacBook Pro I bought coming up on 3 years ago does still work fine. I mean, there's really nothing wrong with it. It's a great machine. Still, you know, very powerful, very fast, really nothing terribly wrong with it. But I drive the poor thing hard. What is that phrase? She looks like she was rode hard and put away wet. I mean, that's the way I treat my my MacBook Pros. So imagine taking a three-year-old machine, recording audio in GarageBand while streaming video and audio over the internet at the same time. Poor little thing, it's all hot and toasty doing all of that. I keep wondering whether she'd burst into flames at some point. So anyway, you can imagine my excitement when Steve said on Tuesday that they'd be in stores by Wednesday. Our local Apple store opens at 10, so I waited till about 10:01 to call them and see if they had them yet. They said, no, we don't have them yet. Probably won't get them today. I don't know what Steve was talking about. And I said, but he promised. And she said, no, don't even believe it. So I waited till noon to call him again. Nothing. Called him at 5 o'clock. Yes, they had them. So I jumped in my car as soon as I got out of work and I raced over there and I bought one right away. Wanted to be the first one to get one. Now, lest you think I decided in haste which one to buy, I did spend 24 whole hours discussing with my Mac friends which one I should buy. Clearly a Pro, not a MacBook. But of the pros, should I get the 2.4 gigahertz or the 2.53? Well, see, I've always been a buy-the-middle kind of person. I don't like the low end. I don't like the high end. I like the middle one. It's just right. But he used to always give me three choices. Now he's only given me two. I knew if I bought the lower end one for $2,000, I'd still have to pump the memory up to 4 gig from 2, and I would definitely have to bump the internal drive from 250 up to 320, because now I'm settled into my 320 gig drive that Pat Dingler put in. So I ran the price comparison, and that left the two models still $200 apart. So I had to think about what differences there were. I discovered that for that extra $200, you get double the L2 cache from 3 meg to 6, and double the video RAM from 256 megabytes to 512. I had no idea if these were something I needed or not. So I asked both Victor Cahiao and David Sparks, and without missing a beat, they said I needed that extra cache. I definitely needed that extra video RAM. Well, you know, I wanted that to be the answer anyway, so even though I don't understand exactly why I needed those features, that's what I did. I went for the 2.53 gigahertz machine. So I raced home, unpacked it, made video, of course, of unpacking it, and I played around with it all night. Well, I didn't want to do too much until I'd moved all my data and programs over. So that night before I went to bed, I got ready to transfer all of the data from my old MacBook Pro to my new one. First problem, the MacBook Pro doesn't have FireWire 400. It's only got FireWire 800. And I didn't have an adapter, and I didn't have a cable with the different adapters on each end. Oh, shoot. Then I found out from someone you could use a network cable to do the transfer. Cool. Well, it's 100 megabits per second instead of 400, but I'll just let it run all night. Now, I do have 212 gigabytes to transfer. So at 400 megabits a second, that should have taken 1.63 hours. Or at 100 megabits per second, it should take about 6.5 hours. Still no worries. By the time I wake up, everything will be there. I know these are theoretical limits, but in this case, it's not like there's a router or anything in between these two systems. I would have thought it would hit pretty close to that limit. Well, when I got up in the morning, it said I had 19 hours and 16 minutes left to go, which coincidentally is what it said when I went to bed. It only transferred about 10% of the data, too. So I quit it and unplugged it. I heard later from listener Ryan that Apple published a fix for this problem the very afternoon after I tried this. All right, well, back to the Apple store. I told the guys in there that from now on, whenever they sell one of these MacBook Pros, they should say, "Do you want fries with that?" Because when you buy the MacBook Pro, they should tell you that you need adapter cables because Steve changed the connectors yet again. Oh, yeah. I also had to get a DisplayPort adapter, too, so I could connect my cruddy old VGA display to the new Mac, too. By the way, Steve, that's a hint. I need that 24-inch cinema display for Christmas, okay? Okay. Anyway, so Thursday morning, I had a telecon for work that was at the crack of dawn. I work with a bunch of people in Boston, and on the good news days, it's only 7 a.m. for these telecons. So I thought I'd just do it from home. So I set up my work laptop on my desk, along with my old MacBook Pro and my new MacBook Pro, so I could start transferring the data from the old to the new. As you can imagine, I didn't have a lot of disk space left with all those laptops and that cruddy old external monitor. When it came time to do the telecon, I decided to use my Blue Ant Supertooth Light, which is a Bluetooth speaker that's designed to go in your car, but it happens to just be a terrific speakerphone. So I started my call, and I needed a place to set the Blue Ant down, and I gently set it down on the right-hand side of the new MacBook Pro. Imagine my dismay when, in the middle of the telecon, I heard, for the third time in 6 months now, that deadly tick, tick, tick that means a disk drive is failing. What the heck? How could my brand new MacBook Pro be failing? I reached over and I grabbed the Blue Ant to pick it up, but suddenly it seemed to weigh more than it did when I first set it down. What the heck is that? As I pulled it off, I suddenly remembered that the Blue Ant comes with a handy visor clip that it sticks to. Sure, you've guessed this by now, it sticks to it with magnets. Big, strong magnets, two of them. Yes, I fried my brand new MacBook Pro. Less than, wait, what was it, a day? Maybe a little over a day that I had it, I managed to completely blow it away. Well, let's talk morals now. I got on Twitter and I got on chat and I talked to some friends of mine, and I was encouraged to just go into Apple and go, I don't know, it won't boot up. I can't figure it out. I don't know what's wrong. It won't boot up. But I decided that I really couldn't live with myself if I did that. I could live with myself if Apple had pity on me, but I could also live with myself and with them if they said, man, you're an idiot. Good luck with that. Now, luckily, the MacBook Pro has a really, really easily accessible disk drive, so it would be a pretty simple matter to pop it out, and Pat Dengler tipped me off to some low prices over at Fry's, even though I can't stand Fry's, but it was only about $100 for a replacement disk. But I decided to go over into Apple and chat with them. So I should back up a little bit. When I was frantic about this thing having died, I just felt like I had to do something. So I popped the battery cover off and I pulled the battery out. I don't know why. I thought somehow things would change if I pulled the battery, but I just wanted to do something, you know, something with my hands, something somehow to try to get this thing fixed. Because I'd already tried booting from a CD and or a DVD, and I'd already tried booting from an external FireWire disk and from my other MacBook Pro. Nothing would work. So I pulled the battery, and then I tried to put it back in, and I don't know if it was because I was frantic or what, but it got kind of jammed in there trying to put it back in, and I couldn't get it back out. And I'm pulling, I'm prodding, I'm rocking. It is not budging. I can't get it to move. So the way they designed this MacBook Pro battery is it's got a little plastic tab on it, kind of like the ones you have in a radio, you know, to pull the batteries out that sits underneath the batteries. This one's kind of stuck in the middle of it. Well, I pull, and that stupid little plastic tab just comes back in my hands. Now I'm in tears. I'm going to jump off a cliff. So luckily, Pat called me, and she talked me down. She said, it's not that big a deal, Allison. You know, if you got to buy a new drive, we can work this. It'll be all right. So I did not shoot myself at that point. So I went over to Apple, and the first thing I did was I showed them how I couldn't even get the battery out. I couldn't get it in. I couldn't close the case. It was a mess. And so these two guys worked on it for a while, and I'm acting all pitiful and sad. And the first thing the guy says was, I've already pulled one of these tabs off already. So yeah, this is a bad design. And the other guy who hadn't seen it yet looks at it and he goes, seriously? Seriously? They thought this was going to work. Seriously, they really did. I mean, he was incredulous that Apple had such a dumb design. So anyway, at the end of getting them, they showed me how to get my battery in and out without jamming it again. And I'd been done looking pathetic and everything. That's when I confessed to them what I did to the drive. So my best friend Spencer took it over to the Genius, and the Genius was able to get it to boot off a DVD after all, and he was able to get into Disk Utility, but there was nothing there. I mean, it was just toast. It was trashed. So he comes back to me and he says, we're going to give you a new one. Unbelievable. Never really thought that was going to happen. At the very least, I just wanted to get my battery back in, but he said he would get me a new one. So I give him a big hug. I was so excited. And then he went in the back and he came back out and he says, the bad news is we don't have any. Oh, so I took my hug back. Anyway, he got the genius to write down on a little card that I had indeed, he had promised me that he would give me a new one. So the next morning at 10 o'clock, I stood in line, ran in the door right as they opened, and I got a new one. So anyway, it was a pretty good day in the end. And I think Apple is, I'm not sure they would do this for everybody. I'm not sure it would happen all the time. There's probably, if I'd gone in all snotty, I'm sure that wouldn't have worked. But I'm thinking back to many, many years ago when Apple was a very different company. And I actually had a power adapter that was arcing when I would plug it into the computer. I mean, it would arc, it would spark as I was trying to put it in. I called Apple and they asked me when I bought it. And it was 3 years, or it was 1 year and 3 days out of, since I bought it. And I didn't have AppleCare. And they told me to pound sand. They said, nope, not going to do anything for you. I said, well, fire damage? I mean, come on, you guys, what's going on here? What are you going to do? And they said, no, we're not going to do anything for you. No, that's it. So anyway, it was a big difference to Apple today from where they were many years ago. That's for sure. Well, I promise I won't talk about the new computer for the entire show, but I do want to walk through some things I like and dislike. By the way, when I got the second new computer, it didn't take 1.67 hours to transfer the 212 gigabytes over FireWire 800, which should have been, was probably operating a FireWire 400. It took 6 hours to do it, but at 400 megabits a second, it should have taken 1.67 hours. There's no router, there's no switches, just a FireWire cable between them. I would really like someone to explain to me why they even give us those numbers if they're off by a factor of 3.5 under nearly ideal conditions. I would sure like to know that. Well, while I'm chattering on about this, I'm watching the chat room going, and Truck Lover suggests it's the speed of the drives themselves. These are 5,400 RPM drives. I wonder if that does affect it. I didn't get the 7,200. I went for the 5,400 drive. So maybe that has something to do with it. Good tip, Truck Lover. Well, anyway, I put a link in the show notes to a couple of options for the FireWire 400-800 issue. The first one I put in there was the Belkin cable that has an 800 connector on one end and 400 on the other. That costs about $22 at Amazon, or you can pay $30 at Apple like I did, or go for $40 to buy it directly from Belkin. The next option is a lot more expensive, but kind of a bit slicker. It's an ExpressCard 34 slot card that gives you two FireWire 400 jacks and an extra USB 2.0 connector for $49. Kind of a nice little device, but kind of steep. Finally, I put in a link for the Sonnet FireWire 400-800 adapter, which is probably the best option. Runs $1,750 at Amazon, and it has a male FireWire 800 plug you put into your new machine. The other end is a female FireWire 400 connector for your standard FireWire cable. The picture in the show notes shows it up next to a AA battery, and it's about the same size. So that's kind of a nice little solution and the cheapest of them all. So you might want to check that out. All right, let's talk about what I like and I don't like. Remember now, I'm coming from the oldest Intel-based Mac when you hear my thoughts. First of all, the display is amazing. It is absolutely, positively gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. If anything, it's a little too bright. I actually had to turn it down when I was working in the evening last night. It's crazy. I think people are worried about the glare and for some reason rabidly upset about the glare of the glass of the glossy screen should really look at this display outside in broad daylight. I mean, it's really unbelievable. I did try sitting outside in really, really bright sunlight, and the reflection was pretty intense. But with my old matte display, I couldn't have seen anything anyway. It would have been too dim. So I don't know. I think the display is just gorgeous. I kind of like the backlit keyboard. It's a little more dramatic now with the chiclet-sized keys with lights all the way around them. I think it's kind of cosmetic because I don't really, I'm not a hunt-and-peck typist, so I don't actually need to see where the keys are, but it's kind of cool. I do like the magnetic closure. It's really pleasing to have no latches, and it closes just like, I mean, it just makes a nice little closing sound. One of the things I like about Apple is their attention to detail. In the Energy Saver preference pane, you know how it's got a little light bulb there for the Energy Saver icon? Well, because of their commitment to green, they've actually changed the Energy Saver icon to a compact fluorescent bulb. I thought that was cute. One thing I like is that it looks different. I was actually kind of disappointed that the first generation MacBook Pros looked exactly like the G4 PowerBooks. For that much money, I wanted something that looked different. Well, now I got it. I got black keys, the black glass bezel around the display, the roundy corners, it's all fun. Imagine, for 6 years I had the same looking computer. Kind of sucked the fun out of that. Until you threw Windows on it, that made it look different, that's for sure. I really like the fact that the disk access is so easy. Not that I want to put Pat Dengler out of business, but it's so nice that with this model, all you do is slide a lever, remove the bottom panel, you can see the battery and the disk drive right there. Could not be easier. I thought the old MacBooks would be easy, but man, this is even easier. Now, I'm kind of excited about the new graphics. These things, the new MacBook Pros have two graphics cards. They have the NVIDIA 9400M, which is supposed to be a pretty darn good mobile graphics card, but that shares memory with the CPU. Then they have the 9600M GT for Turbo Boost that has its own memory. On the lower-end MacBook Pro, it has 256 megabytes RAM or 512 on the higher-end model. I'm not quite sure how to test the faster graphics yet, but I expect I'll enjoy it when I figure it out. Don McAllister said I'd notice it with applications like Pixelmator that use the graphics processor, otherwise known as the GPU, to render things like Gaussian blurs and sharpness. I'll be curious to see whether Photoshop Elements or Aperture take advantage of it. I sure hope so. One thing I don't like about the graphics card is you actually have to log in and log out to get it to switch, and it's buried in the weirdest place. It's a switch in the energy saver control panel that simply says better battery life or faster performance. I think they really should have put a switch someplace else for that, just so you can choose the one that you want. Well, we figured out in chatting with the chat room here that it does technically say graphics to the left of better performance or better battery life. So technically it does say graphics. But if you do a search in all the control panels with the word graphics, nah, you aren't going to find it. Well, I got to tell you, one of the things I do really like, too, is the glass trackpad. I thought it'd be weird with no button, but it's actually almost the entire trackpad that is the button. Think the Matrix. There is no spoon. Well, almost the entire thing depresses, except for about the top inch of it. And so it just, the whole thing clicks in and out. So it's just like, it is sort of like what Steve said when he said, you don't have to find the button, which I thought was funny because it's like, oh yeah, I would search around for hours trying to find that button to click, you know. I didn't think that was a big deal. But it is a little more intuitive that you're just, you know, you're already on the trackpad, you just tap that thing and it works. I like the smoothness of the surface, I like how big it is, and you can assign the bottom left corner or the bottom right corner to be right click, and that works really well. You can also, the four-finger gesture is kind of funny. I thought, wait, four fingers? Okay, come on. How weird manipulation is that? But it turns out you just lay your four fingers on and you sweep up, and all of a sudden your whole, your desktop will show up. So it basically does, I just did it for the chat room. Basically, it just does expose for you. And if you go down, it shows you all of your application windows, another expose feature. And then if you go to the side, it shows you your application switcher. And it's really, really nice. I think those are nice little features, so I kind of like that. Let's talk a little bit about what I don't like. Oh, wait, I'm going to stop for just a second. Willie said, why would you like the right click on the left? I have no idea, but that's exactly what I did. I put the right click on the left-hand side. I don't know. I think because I tend to do it with my left hand because I'm used to holding down the control key to right click. That's the only thing I can think of, but I don't know. It's just kind of weird. That's just the way I am. So let's see, I started talking about what I didn't like, and one of the big things I don't like is the sharp corner along the edge where your wrist rests. It hurts my little wrist. The old one had a rubber gasket around that, and I like that better. Now it's real sharp, so I got to pay attention to how I prop it up in my lap and get it adjusted where I don't jam my wrist into it. It's not a lot thinner. Remember, my old MacBook Pro was an inch thick. I think they got thinner or thicker since then, and now they're back to this thinner one. And now it's 0.95 inches thick, but the curviness is kind of nice. Speed. I'm looking for crazy fast, but I'm not sure I'm seeing it yet. I did have an example where I did something on Levelator, and it just screamed on that for me. I was really, really happy with that. But GarageBand export normalizing wasn't, blow my socks off impressive yet. I got to watch how it does after I record the show. That'll be probably a better test of it. But I did about a 20-minute bit, and it, I don't know, it wasn't like, wow, it's done already? That's crazy. Love Later definitely was, wow, it's done already? That's crazy. So let's see. Oh, one other thing that was instantaneous that used to be just long enough to irritate me was Rapido Write, which I used to do my little shortcut character things. It used to take about 5 seconds to save or 3 seconds to save it when I put in a new shortcut, but now it's just basically the blink of an eye, and that's really nice. Again, the other thing I don't like is the battery insertion. I mean, the battery's huge, and it's tricky to get back in, so if it weren't for Spencer, I don't know if I'd even have the battery back in yet. So overall, I'm pretty darn happy with it, and I think I'll enjoy it even more as I explore everything it can do. Did I mention that I'm in love with the screen? Well, I have purposely avoided doing iPhone applications because I think, I don't know, there's been a lot of talk on the iPhone, but I have two I wanted to very briefly describe. You know, a lot of people really hate typing on the iPhone virtual keyboard, right? Well, the folks over at ShapeWriter, Inc. have created a free application for the iPhone and iPod Touch that lets you type while sliding your finger over the keyboard instead of tapping. They call the application Writing Pad, and it's one weird piece of software, but I think I like it. It's amazing how smart it is. It seems to know about 90% of what I'm writing. Sometimes you do need to teach it a new word, which you can easily do. And also, if it misses a word, it gives you a list across the screen of what you might have meant, so you can easily just click on the right word. The bad thing is, this means that you pretty much have to check at the end of every word whether you got it right, instead of powering away writing and writing and writing like you do in the normal, keypad. Once you've written a note, it turns out you can actually hit the email button at the bottom and send it right over to the iPhone or iPod Touch email program. Essentially, it does a copy and paste for you, which is awesome. I think the accuracy can be improved, but for now, and for free, I think it's a very interesting piece of software that solves a real problem. I put a link in the show notes to where you can see exactly what it looks like over at the iTunes store. The other application came from listener Lynn's husband, Gary, and I'm even more excited about this one because it's an HP 11C Scientific RPN calculator. Yes, another reverse Polish notation calculator. This really excites me because this one from RLM Software is my dream. It's exactly the model that I have been using since college. I still use my HP 11C calculator, and I inherited my dad's when he passed away, so I have one in each of my desks. This one is $999, which is a bit steep for the application store, but since it's a specialty item for fanatics like me, I'm sure it's going to be a big hit in that crowd. Thanks, Gary, for a great pick.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, it's time for Dumb Question Corner, and we have a couple of good ones this week. Margaret wrote in with a great dumb question. Here's what she said. I like to record a radio program that has been converted into a podcast. Usually there are 9 episodes to a single day of the radio program. The problem is that when I transfer the episodes onto my iPod, the order is last episode first to be played. That means if I want to listen to the episodes in order of how they were originally broadcast, they are actually backwards on my iPod. I've gone into iTunes help with no luck. I even went to the trouble of renaming in the info tab the track number to read 1 of 9, 2 of 9, and so on. I even checked the part of a compilation box. Still, the podcast loads into my iPod as last episode first. How do I get the episodes loaded into my iPod in the order I want? And is it possible to get all of the episodes to play one after another, just like an audiobook, so I don't have to stop every 10 minutes and adjust my iPod to cue the next episode? Thanks, Margaret. Well, I love this question because I actually know the answer to an iPod question. I never know the answer to iPod questions. All you have to do is make a playlist. That's how I solve the problem for long road trips where I won't be able to fiddle with the iPod while driving. Just rearrange them into the order you want and start playing, and the top one will play first, and it'll just go right down the list. I am so excited I was able to answer an iPod question. Thanks, Margaret. Our next dumb question is from Karen. Here's what she says. Perhaps this is the first time you've received a dumb question via Facebook. My sister told me that I should never start my car while my iPod is plugged into the power, for example, the cigarette lighter. Is this true? I have an iPod Touch, not that it really matters probably which one I have. Well, yes, Karen, you are the very first person to use Facebook to submit a dumb question. What a cool idea. I thought about winging an answer to this one, but then I thought, why not ask Honda Bob? Here's what he said. That is not so dumb a question. The fact is, power to the power outlet on most cars doesn't get power until the engine starts anyway. So turning the switch from off to start has no effect on anything plugged into it. If anything, it loses power only momentarily. Well, I double-checked with him to make sure there's no chance of a power surge, and he said, a power surge, never. A power drop-off, always. So, the bottom line is, I think you're safe leaving your iPod or anything else plugged into the cigarette lighter of your car. Thanks for the question, Karen. I did start thinking, I wonder how long we're going to call them cigarette lighters since hardly anybody smokes anymore. Maybe someday we will just call them the power outlets. Well, speaking of Honda Bob, we got a question from a listener on whether he works on hybrid Hondas. Lynn was wondering because he didn't have anything up on his incredibly informative website about hybrids. Well, ask and ye shall receive. Bob immediately wrote up a whole section on how the hybrid integrated motor assist vehicles work. One of the things I love about Honda Bob's site at htabob.com is that while he will only work on Hondas and Acuras, his website is very informative no matter what kind of car you have. The page on the hybrids is no exception. It's an explanation of how the hybrid assist works, walking you through the contributions from the engine, the electric motor, the powertrain computer unit, the transmission, and the battery pack. Head on over to the link in the show notes to learn more. If there are questions you'd like answered on Honda Bob's site, just shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. Heck, while you're writing to him, schedule your next maintenance or repair for your Honda or Acura with him. That is, of course, if you live in the LA or Orange County areas. He also accepts appointments by that time-tested but somewhat archaic method, the telephone. Give him a call at 562-531-2321. HEA Bob's Mobile Service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. My son has been involved with the running team at his high school for a couple of years now, and I've gotten a bit involved with the parents who run the booster club. The team mom was wonderful. She kept an email list of all of the 150 students and runners and as many parents as she could muster, sending out emails about upcoming meets, who lost a sweatshirt, when to send money, and what time the buses would pick up the kids. One problem, though, her ISP decided that she must be a spammer because of these mass emails she was sending out, so she'd have to break it up into chunks. Another problem was that 100% of the communications had to go through her. So we, you know, so if Billy lost his sweatshirt, Billy's mom had to call her. She had to send out the email. And then when somebody said, oh, yeah, I found it, she would get the sweatshirt from the person, get it back to them. Well, we sat down and pumped all of those email addresses into a Google group, which was harder than it should have been. It, too, kept barfing if we tried to do too many addresses at once. But after enough tries, we got all of the names in. I'm really, really pleased how this works now, though. If Bobby's mom finds a sweatshirt, she can write to the whole group instead of going through the team mom, over to the right kid, back to the team mom, back to Bobby's mom. It works flawlessly, and more communication is going on now than ever it was before. Okay, next problem to solve. We have a home meet coming up that looks like it's going to require a great deal of parent involvement. One mom said she'd maintain a list of all the volunteers, so we went back and forth on the best way to do this. She had an Excel spreadsheet, which I could have exported to HTML and stuffed into our WordPress website, also created by moi. But that's a pain, because Excel makes such dreadful HTML, you have to do a lot of editing to even make it readable, and it's a pain in the butt to edit. And again, every parent would have to contact this mom, and then she would have to edit it online. She thought it'd be much easier if we just had something in the Google Groups. She started experimenting around, and between the two of us, we found the solution. While it technically works, it wasn't quite what I wanted it to be, but maybe somebody knows the solution out there. I noticed in the chat room, Truck Lover is guessing Google Documents, sort of. Well, it turns out there's a feature in Google Groups where you can create a document that anyone in the group can edit. Like Truck Lover suggesting, it's probably part of Google Docs, but instead of being in the spreadsheet format that I really wanted, it was only the word processor that was available that I could find. Couldn't figure out how to get a table in there either. So I put it in using non-variable spaced font. You know, if you try to make a table using spaces in a normal font, it never lines up right. Well, if you use a font like Courier instead, where every character takes up the same amount of space, the columns do line up nicely. So I cut and pasted all 38 parents' information in, made it Courier, and it looked great. Very tedious to do, but once I had it in, it was fine. Now, every person who's a member of the group can go in and add their name. And it's instantly updated. That's perfect. Very cool. Exactly what I wanted. Well, until someone accidentally messed up the font on a couple of lines. No worries. I'll just go back in, change it back to Courier, right? Wrong. I changed it to Courier, hit save, and it changed back. I even went to the source text, changed it there, and it would change it back. I went back and forth messing with this stupid thing for over an hour before I beat it into submission. I have no idea why it was so lame and how anyone could claim that Google Docs is ready for primetime if that was indeed Google Docs I was in. What a mess. If anyone has other suggestions on this or can explain why it did this, I'd sure like to hear about it. Have you ever wished you could do something to help us understand earthquakes? Well, living in earthquake territory in California, this is something very near and dear to my heart. My husband Steve told me about an effort called the Quake Catcher Network, or QCN, at Stanford to use the accelerometers in Mac and Windows laptops to detect tremors in the earth. How cool is that? The accelerometers are there, by the way, to make sure that if you drop your laptop, it'll measure the acceleration and say, "Woo, better pull the head away from the disk so you don't hear the tick, tick, tick sound of which I'm so fond." Even though when you hear that noise, it means a visit from Pat Dingler. I don't want to hear it ever again, seriously. Anyway, that's why the accelerometers are in there. These guys at the QCN have figured out a way to use those accelerometers to detect earthquakes. It works in a very SETI at home and folding at home kind of way. Those are the distributed processing algorithms created to harness the untapped CPU power across the world into a virtual grid computer. My friends who understand grid computing would probably yak at my lack of precision on that description, but hey, that's the way it goes. Get your own show if you want to be precise. Anyway, if you go to qcn.stanford.edu, you can download the free software Boink, B-O-I-N-C, from boink.berkeley.edu. Isn't that kind of sweet? Berkeley and Stanford collaborating on this? All kumbaya together? Well, it's kind of ironic, I think, because those are my son's top picks for schools to attend next fall. That's probably why I noticed it. Anyway, Boink is a program that lets you donate your idle computer time to science projects like SETI at Home, climateprediction.net, Rosetta at Home, World Community Grid, and many, many others. Once you load up Boink, you simply enter the URL they give you over at QCN, and your computer starts waiting for something exciting to happen earthquake-wise. Boink didn't ask permission, but it inserted itself into my startup items, which I guess makes sense. You wouldn't have to think, gee, I wonder if there'll be an earthquake today. Maybe I should turn on Boink just in case. So it does make sense that it did that. One thing that freaked me out, after I installed it, it asked me for my name and country I wanted to claim, which I did. Then it asked me for my zip code, which I chose not to give up. It then took me to a webpage where it identified exactly where I was sitting in my house on a map. Seriously, it claims it did this by IP only. Is that actually possible? Anyway, it asked me to identify some locations I go to frequently, so I guess if you took your laptop to work every day, you could tell it you're there sometimes. I'm going to run this for a while and see if it picks anything up. It does not interrupt you while you're working. It doesn't run at all, which I think I'd actually rather it did that a little bit because I never leave my laptop running when I'm not using it. So I'm not sure I'll be able to help, but maybe you guys leave yours on for a while and maybe it could help. If you want to do your part to provide data to earthquake analysts, head over to the Quake Catcher Network and get involved. I'm continuing to really enjoy using ScreenSteps to document things I know how to do on the Mac and on Windows. This tool allows you to make very professional documentation, like PDF manuals complete with a table of contents, or HTML versions suitable for a website. It even lets you publish your lessons up to your blog. You can take screen snapshots, annotate with boxes, circles, arrows, and even sequence steps, just in case there's a lot of things to do on one screenshot. Type in titles for each step, then type in all the instructions for that step, but then let ScreenSteps do all the heavy lifting of formatting the pages, wrapping text around graphics, creating page breaks, formatting section titles. You never have to worry your pretty little head about these things ever again. Once you turn into a ScreenSteps maniac like me, you'll really appreciate the tagging function. You can tag your lessons, which makes it so easy to find the lesson you're looking for. If you'd like to give ScreenSteps a try, but you're not sure you want to buy it yet, no worries, there's a 30-day free trial. I also highly recommend that you watch their less than 2-minute long video tutorial on how it works so you'll get the idea right away. Screen Steps is $40 for the standard version and $60 for the pro version. But if you add to the coupon code NOSILLA, that's all capital letters, if you enter that in when you buy, you get 25% off. So you can actually get the pro version for the regular version price. Just click on the big Screen Steps logo in the sidebar over at podfeet.com and get started. It's time for a surprise episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. And we didn't expect to have a call with you this week, but we're doing it after all.
Yeah, well, we sort of half expected to. We sort of figured we'd try it. I was away for a couple of days at a wedding up in the north of Ireland. Well, in north of Ireland, that's not in Northern Ireland. It's very confusing. But it was absolutely lovely, fantastic wedding, lovely time. And since we got back early on Sunday, I figured, why not see if Alison's game for some chat?
Yay,
which
I would miss
it
if we didn't have that chat.
Exactly. The Sunday just wouldn't be complete. How's the eye? Are we still one-eyed or are we back to being fully bifocal?
I'm actually fully bifocal. By Monday, it just kind of felt like it was dry. And by Tuesday, it was feeling pretty good. And Wednesday, I threw my contacts in and I've been fine ever since. So,
without the acid.
Yeah, got really lucky. Actually, when I went in to get my contacts checked out for another reason, I was talking to my contact lens guy, Billy, and he said he knew, has seen two people in his lifetime, two women who carried super glue in their purses for their fingernails and they put that in their eyes.
Ooh.
And they lost their eye. They each lost their eye. So any women out there, if you're carrying super glue in your purse, just get rid of it. Just unless you don't use eye drops. And so,
super glue.
Yeah.
That's not meant to go. No.
I felt pretty good about hydrogen peroxide after that. So.
Yeah, it's just some acid. It's not an adhesive.
Let's stop. Oh, I don't even like to think about it.
No.
Well, let's see. The first thing we wanted to talk quickly about, Julie B. wrote in on the blog and asked an interesting question. Here's what she said in reference to some of our conversation last week. She said, I was planning on adding NoScript to my Firefox add-ons, but stopped when I saw that the author is not verified. How do I know that downloading this is not the beginning of the clickjacking? Why isn't the author verified? What does verification entail? Art?
Okay, I don't have an answer to everything there. I've been trying to figure out what it means to be verified or not, and the FAQ on NoScript and on Firefox have let me down, as has Google. But I can answer the whole, how do I know it's not clickjacking getting started? I guess it all comes down to trust, at some extent. However, NoScript has been around for a very long time. It's built up a very big community, and it's proposed as a solution by experts in the security field. So it's not just some fly-by-night thing that came out of nowhere. It is actually a product with a very long history that has been looked at by a lot of security people. Steve Gibson is always recommending it. And it's also been recommended on Securosis, which is a fairly good security blog as well. So, you know, it's been out there for a long time, it's been known for a long time, and it's trusted by the professionals. So I'm prepared to trust the professionals, and therefore I'm prepared to trust NoScript. Okay. I sort of lost my thread a bit there because Skype died, which apparently happened a lot during the Mac Roundtable as well, you were saying, Alison.
Yeah, a little unreliable this week.
Anyway, so I think what I'd said was that, it's a matter of, you need to have a sort of a chain of trust is what this thing all comes down to. And, you know, NoScript has stood that test very well. It's not some fly-by-night operation. It didn't just come out of nowhere a few weeks ago. It's been around for quite some time and has been looked at by the big head honchos in security. And they recommend that. And also, if you look at it on the Firefox site, it actually has a little recommended badge next to it when you do a search. So Firefox recommended, security experts recommended, in particular Steve Gibson.
Well, but
and it has been around.
She's probably got a good question, though. If you, just,
she has.
If somebody says, "Okay, here's a cool plugin," and she goes to Firefox plugins and she sees that the author is not verified, and she's never heard of this thing other than somebody telling her it's neato, does that mean she shouldn't click on it?
Yeah, it does actually. It's a pretty common way of getting viruses onto people's machines is to pretend to be antivirus. I mean, it's been really common on the Windows platform. You get these emails saying, you are infected with a virus. Here is this cure, ironically a virus.
But this isn't a case of clicking on a link in an email. This is going to the Firefox plugins and saying,
yes,
I want to get this. Would you?
Exactly.
You'd still be nervous about it if it said the author's not verified.
No, I would. My nervousness would depend on where and who told me to get it and on you know, how many people, whether I've seen it recommended elsewhere, whether this thing is at version 6 or whether this thing has just come out of nowhere and was published for the first time last week. Hmm. I mean, all of those things are important. Something that's been around for a long time and that, you know, has stood the test of time is a lot more trustworthy than something that's just magically sprouted up overnight. I mean, it may be great if it's sprouted up overnight, but I personally wouldn't be prepared to take a risk on something like that.
Even if it was in the Firefox add-ins, you got it through Firefox, not through a link.
If it was in the Firefox site and Firefox had put a recommended banner next to it, then I would personally believe those guys. I have faith in the Firefox guys, so I would take their word on it.
I have
faith in Steve Gibson, so I take Steve Gibson's word for it. I guess that's what it comes down to. It's who you want to put your trust in.
But I'm not going to go check with Steve Gibson on every add-on I want to put in.
No, but it's most important for security stuff, I think.
Okay.
And I have to say, personally, I probably would trust it if it had been listed on the Mozilla site, because you don't automatically come onto that site. You have to submit it to Mozilla.
Oh, okay.
And there's a submission process involved. It's not just that you magically show up there. So I have some faith in that. It's a bit like having faith in something like... I can't think of anything there. But anyway, I would have some faith if it's appeared there, and I'd certainly have faith if it had had a bunch of reviews. You know, if it was a completely blank site where no one had commented on it, no one had done anything, and it had just been sitting there only for a couple of days, I probably would think twice, to be honest.
Okay, well...
I really like this question because it shows that people are thinking the right way. You know, be suspicious. You can never be too suspicious.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm finding I've been running NoScript since NoScript since last week, and I do a search on an image, and I get a bunch of links for, you know, I'm trying to find a picture of somebody, and every site I go to, I have to approve something with NoScript. And I don't know these sites from Adam.
Why would you be approved? Surely you shouldn't need to approve it just to look at an image.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
most filters. What if you just click on the button? I presume you're using Google Image Search.
Right.
So just click on the show full size option at the top there. I wouldn't go around approving sites like that.
Well, but that's the thing. I mean, everywhere I go, every single thing I do, I'm having to tell NoScript, yeah, okay. Because I don't know how to tell.
I tend to do an awful lot of browsing with no JavaScript on. I mean, so what if it's sitting there whining about JavaScript? As long as I can see what I want to see, I don't care.
But that's the problem. I can't see what I want to see. Pull downs aren't there. I just tried to go to Ustream. Well, none of the Java stuff, of course, is going to work there. But Lots of things don't work.
Big web app though. Ustream is a lot more than just a website. So if if you just do a random image search for something, you shouldn't need to be approving everything.
Oh, but I mean, I'm not approving everything. I'm approving the site usually is what I'll do. Like, I mean, I go to my credit union, it won't work because I can't open the calendars. Almost everything I go to, there's something that functionally will not work. Not that I just can't see what I want. I functionally can't use the site. Like I couldn't even log in to Ustream, not broadcasting. I couldn't log in without approving the site.
Absolutely, but Ustream is a complicated web app, so of course you'd have to approve that, and it's one that you are going to be using all the time, and you have been using all the time. So yeah, approve it and be done with it. Same goes for your bank, obviously. JavaScript is used an annoyingly large amount, as becomes very clear when you use NoScript. So just imagine what the world would be like if you were going with the other extreme, which is saying no JavaScript. I mean, it's not practicable at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, no, I'm not going to do that. That's for sure.
I still think you're better off doing that than wandering around where any mislink could lead you to all sorts of trouble.
All right. Well, let's switch gears here. You had your first travel experience with your iPhone in Ireland. What did you think of it?
I was actually very pleasantly surprised. As luck would have it, the hotel Wi-Fi was broken. So I ended up using my iPhone quite a lot. But on the way out, I'd used it as well in the car. And I have to say it was a bizarre experience the first time sitting there in the back of the car, traveling along at probably over the speed limit, to be honest, traveling along at about 140 kilometers an hour to the middle of Ireland, because we went literally clean across the country, tapping away, writing an email to Alison. There's something wrong about this.
No, you weren't driving.
And the fact that when I hit send, no, I wasn't driving. Good Lord. Don't do that while driving. But while on the road, I installed a WordPress plugin. I made a post to my blog using that plugin. It just worked really well. And I was very surprised at how much coverage I had, even when going through, you know, what we would politely call the back of beyond. Yeah, granted, I saw a lot of the little E, but I saw a very surprising amount of 3G coverage as well.
Oh, that's good. So Ireland's pretty well covered.
It would seem to be well covered by O2. I mean, I've always had Vodafone cell phones up to now, and I have to say I was quite impressed. You know, the GPS also worked very, very well. It was pretty quick to lock on. And very accurate. We were always shown to be on the green line, which is probably a good thing because the green line was the road.
Well, that's good.
Actually, it was great fun because it you know, we were driving up in the dark. And the way back, it was in the daytime and, you know, you can look around and stuff. But in the dark, if you're not concentrating on the road, it's very easy to have no idea where you are very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so just, you know, just flick it up. It was very quick to update and say, oh, great. Okay, so we're a quarter of the way. But yeah, it took 4 hours, which I hate long drives.
I think one of the things that I think is misleading to a lot of people when they talk about the touch is they try to say that the iPod Touch is an iPhone without a phone, but it's not. It's really not. It's an iPod with a really bitchin' screen. There's, you know, and some.
Yeah,
Wi-Fi.
I wouldn't agree with that. I wouldn't go that far. It's an iPhone that only works when you're at home. And
yes,
doesn't have a phone.
But I mean, there's just so much you can't do. Obviously, GPS coordinates on a map are not very interesting when you're at home. So
you should know where you are.
One would hope. So the GPS stuff, you know, and I only have the fake GPS with the first generation iPhone. Yeah. What is the one from the movie? Oh, well. I look at it as just so much more. I mean, the fact that you can't surf in the car, you can't find phone numbers, you can't blog. I haven't blogged for mine yet, but I mean, you can't do Twitter, you can't do AIM. There's just so much you can't do on the touch that you can do on the iPhone because of using the cell network.
Yeah, it just, I mean, you know, I used the iPod Touch for email from bed because I was lazy, but now I could do email from anywhere, and that's right. A very big difference.
My son, when he's bored, he just pushes the little button to find out where he is.
Now, what also struck me is this would have been the first time I would have been using the keypad while, you know, moving. And when you're in a moving car, your accuracy in typing goes downhill fast.
Yeah.
The auto correction is fantastic.
Really?
You just got to trust in it and keep going. Plow on regardless, and it will correct itself.
Yeah, I agree with that. You definitely have to, if you stop and look at every word as you're going, it's going to make you crazy. And I think that's what most people do. I think you really need to just go bam, 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 bam. Just keep typing.
Yeah, and have faith that it will come out right. Have a read over it again, just in case it didn't quite get right. But I was really shocked by the accuracy. The entire blog post I wrote, it didn't get anything wrong once.
Wow, that's pretty good.
It wasn't a long post. It wasn't a giant big essay, but it was long enough to say what needed to be said.
Well, and that's a good point because you did have a typo in the one that you typed with your keyboard, right?
Yeah, I regularly have typos. So if there's a typo from the iPhone, it's not necessarily the iPhone's fault.
Definitely. Well, what else did you notice about it? What did you like?
Actually, I have to say I was pleasantly surprised by the battery because everyone had been saying that the 3G's chew through batteries like, you know, there's no tomorrow, as it were. But honestly, I was using it for 2 days at a time while I was up there, and I wasn't using it as an iPod, I have to say, which is what I usually would do. Mm-hmm. Because, well, I was with family and stuff. You don't stick earbuds in your ear when you're at a family event. That would be most rude.
Right.
But I was constantly checking my email, surfing around on the web, cheating in table quizzes.
Well, good.
You know, I mean, I was using it a lot.
And you used it for 2 days, you said?
Yeah. Now, granted, I was on holiday, so one could argue there were 2 half days.
Oh, okay.
But I forgot to put it in the airplane mode at night, so it was on standby all night.
Well, that's fantastic.
I keep forgetting to do that, actually. One of these nights, I'm going to get a horrible wake up at 4 a.m. when some idiot rings me.
So that's good. I think they said that there were some significant improvements with the latest firmware update that they had.
It's possible. Because, right, I charged it this morning, So I've gone the whole way down the road, regularly checking the GPS, messing around on email. I listened to MacBreak Weekly when I got home, and I can barely notice a chunk out of the battery. It's got to be over 80%.
Wow, that's good. I don't know what everybody's
wondering. I also made one phone call.
I think people. You know, now, I think some people are real heavy phone users, and maybe that makes a big difference.
Possibly, but I can't afford to be a heavy phone user on my plan.
Yeah, no. What's your data plan limit on this?
Data plan's a gig. That could get interesting too.
I wonder, because I mean, it's not like you're going to be downloading podcasts since Apple won't let us have the podcatcher, right?
Actually, I should probably change my opinion on this whole thing, because I would probably be on the high road for big trouble if they were to allow podcasts to be downloaded.
So you could say that Apple just did that as a courtesy to you then, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so in the... Okay, so far, cellular network data, I have received 10 megabytes. And wow. I've sent one.
Wow, and that's in how long?
Since I got the phone.
And that was how long ago?
So, a week and a bit. So, a friend of mine insisted that there was no month he ever went over 200. And he told me not to worry.
Yeah.
And he would be a heavy user as well. Because it's just email and web browsing, the amounts are actually small.
Go check out some YouTube videos. I bet you could jack that up.
Yeah, that's the other thing I was going to say. A friend of mine is a huge YouTube fan, and he always complains about the life of the iPhone because it doesn't... He gets the train from Sligo, which I passed through on the way to Maynooth. And that's about a three-hour train ride. And he would spend the entire 3 hours watching YouTube videos and then complain that his battery was dead.
Yeah, that's a lot of radio traffic, a lot of downloads.
Lot of video. Video playback is not easy on the iPod Touches or the iPhones.
So I think that probably has a lot to do with it, is what you use it for.
Yeah. But honestly, I'm using it mainly for web, email. Web and email is really what I'm using it for most, and the GPS and Google Maps, that kind of thing. But really, it's working out very well for that kind of usage. I'm not using it for chat. I'm not using it for Twitter yet. Might go that route. I haven't quite decided if I want to have Twitter follow me.
Oh, I think Twitter's a lot of fun. Well, you don't have to tell it where you are.
No. I mean, I just, when I'm away from the computer, maybe it's good to get away from Twitter. I haven't quite decided. See, I haven't quite decided how much of the internet I want with me and how much I want to break from.
See, that's funny. I'm exactly the other way. That's probably the time I Twitter more than any is when I'm not near my computer. Because if I'm near my computer, I'm doing something. But if I've got my phone and I'm bored in the car or something, that's when you're most likely to hear a Twitter from me.
Well, actually, yeah, that's true, I guess. I'm pretty sure I'll discover every time I get bored, I'm going to whip this thing out and do something. And there's only, you know, once I've checked my email and caught up on what's going on Flickr for the day, the chances are I'm then going to start going, I wonder what app I'll download. Which is how I ended up with something called Iconoid, which is a game, really old game, where you have a little paddle and a little bouncing ball and you have to make all the boxes disappear.
Oh, look.
But you slide your finger over and back.
Is it like Breakout, you mean?
Yeah.
Do you know who wrote Breakout?
No idea.
Steve Wozniak.
Oh, cool.
He wrote it when he was helping Steve Jobs with at Atari at nighttime, not being employed by Atari.
Those were the days. Yeah. And I also picked up Mrs. Pac-Man.
Well, that would be fun. Do you do that by tilting?
You have a choice, actually. You can either have it on tilt, which is actually really awkward and not suitable. There's a little joystick at the bottom, so you can use the touch to move that. Or you can use the mode I use, which is basically flick. So anywhere on the screen, you flick left, right, up, or down, and it obeys.
Are those free apps?
No. Oh. I may have also spent some money.
You know, that's so funny. The micropayments are what's going to be the death of us all, right? It's only $1.
It really is. Yeah. Well, I think one of them, was like 99 cent or something. I think that was the Iconoid, which I think is Breakout. Mm-hmm. The Pac-Man one, I think, was more expensive. It was either $7.99 or $9.99.
Whoa.
But I'd read some really good reviews of it, so I figured, yeah, okay. The other thing I did do, I downloaded the mobile version of WordPress, which is free. And I'm very impressed with it.
That's the WordPress, the blogging utility, right?
Yeah, the blogging utility. It works really well. And I can write stuff offline, which is fantastic.
Oh,
And then submit it later. And I can have as many blogs in here as I want. So I can, type away to my heart's content if I'm waiting somewhere, even if there's no cell signal or if I have to have it in airplane mode. You can work away, which, if you're on a plane, that's probably likely you're going to be in airplane mode. And, whenever you get back to some sort of cell signal, send it away. Or if you're traveling abroad, perhaps wait till you get home so you're not hit with insane roaming charges.
Definitely, definitely. Well, I got to check that out. You know, I don't tend to just blog. My blogs are 99% of the time associated with the show. And I somehow feel like there's a purity to that that I shouldn't muck with. You know, just every once in a while I'll do one. But I suppose there's nothing wrong with me just blogging.
You could always have a separate blog.
Oh, that's too complicated. Then I'd have pressure to keep that up. One of the reasons I named both my website and my show so generically weird is so that no one could say, well, you never said you were going to talk about that. You know, I can talk yes. about Windows if I want, because technically the name of the podcast was No Silicast, but I sort of snuck Mac Podcast into iTunes, if you look closely, because I kept getting people saying, yeah. we don't know what your show was about.
Yeah, but you're ever so slight bias. I mean, you can vary the level of sarcasm depending on how it suits.
Exactly, exactly. It's all up to me.
Exactly.
And nobody can claim they know what Podfeet's about, so there's that.
Yeah, apart from the people you've explained the to.
Well, there's that. All right. Well, I'm glad to hear you're having so much fun with the iPhone. That's fantastic. I'm glad it's making you so happy.
Honestly, I'm really starting to wonder how I did without one. I've only had it a week, and it feels as if I've always had it. And I don't miss my iPod Touch at all. Sorry.
Aww.
I'm still looking for a buyer for that, by the way.
There you go. Well, we can do sales here, too. All right, Bart. Yeah. Well, are we on for next week?
Business as usual for the next 2 weeks.
All right. Sounds good.
Okie dokie. Talk to you then. Bye-bye. Oh, happy computing.
You're out of touch. Well, I'm afraid it's time to call it a day, but you can head over to the Mac Roundtable podcast at macroundtable.com to hear a great show that I was on this week. I'm afraid you will hear my frightening tale about frying my MacBook Pro again, but when you hear what Don McAllister did to me in post-editing, you'll enjoy it even more. We had a great discussion on this week with Don, Victor Cahiao, and David Spark, so be sure to give it a listen. And don't forget to come on into the chat room and watch the live show when you can. We record at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Saturday nights, and we had a big crowd in tonight, probably the biggest one we've had so far. So come on in and join us. Remember, if you want to send in a dumb question, record a review, complain, compliment, or just chat, shoot me an email over at nosilicast@gmail.com. Be sure to follow my nonsense over on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeed. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.